Blog Talk Radio.
Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Well, welcome to Walls in Our Minds. This is Terry Dodd, and I'm here tonight with my co-host, Red Beckman, and Dr. Kate is also co-hosting with us tonight, and it's a possibility that even our friend Kirk McKenzie may be able, let's see, one hour or so, I'll have to drop off for him. Okay, I just got a message from our friend Kirk, and so I believe he'll be calling in and assisting us for a little bit of time tonight. I believe he's got some conflict, so he may not be here for the whole show, but we'll get him in to this conversation sooner or later, because actually our guest tonight, Terry Bax, was originally introduced to me, or my attention was raised as to the situation with the Western Montana water by Kirk McKenzie, who is a part of the, actually the founder of Defend Rural America. And Red, are you on with us yet?
Yes, I'm on.
Well, you're our resident Montanan here tonight, Red, so this should be of great interest to you, what we're going to be talking about tonight. How about you open us with a prayer?
I'll do that. Heavenly Father, we come to you fully aware of how insignificant and how powerless we are without the power and the Spirit that you allot to us and give to us. And we just thank you because we can go to you for help, for wisdom. And, you know, you've got that promise in your word that says if any man lacks wisdom, all we have to do is ask for it. And I can assure you that tonight we need some wisdom to solve this problem that is haunting a lot of people and bothering a lot of people. And we just pray that you, our Heavenly Father, would have your way with this program and give us inspiration where we need inspiration. And we'll give you the praise in Christ's name. Amen.
Well, thank you very much for that, Red. And Kate, I think this would be a good time for you to introduce our guest tonight, since this is something that you are rather familiar with. So are you live? Do you have a live mic, Kate?
Yes, I've got a live mic, and good evening, everyone. Good evening, Red, Terry, and Terry, and everyone who's on the line. Let me start off by saying tonight we've got a very important discussion to talk about, and we have covered different aspects of this in various different parts of our shows. But coming from a standpoint, as you know, I have worked on water rights in Indian country for, excuse me, some 26 years. And recently, I would say within the last few years, I've really begun to see how the tribal lands are being used essentially to accomplish other purposes for the New World Order, including Agenda 21, including transfer of wealth, as Terry had put out in the show description, transfer of wealth, and the interruption of the sovereignty and jurisdiction over individual lands in the West. In Montana, this is a very interesting situation, and I'm very pleased to have Terry Bax join us from Montana. She's a landowner. She's got a very interesting background history in a variety of areas, including journalism, and has been pretty much at the forefront, along with other groups in Montana, to begin to take a look at what's going on water rights in northwestern Montana, where potentially over 350,000 people are going to be affected by a proposed compact, water compact, between the state of Montana, the United States, and the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes, otherwise known as the Flathead Indian Reservation. Through a number of processes, which you'll hear Terry talk about tonight, I would have to say that the water rights are in jeopardy in northwestern Montana, and everyone should ought to take a look at their own states to see how this is working. So without any further ado, I'm going to let Terry just take off, and welcome, Terry. Thank you very much, and please feel free to add any background information that I missed about you. But we surely are very happy to have you here this evening.
The opportunity to share with folks the problem or the issue that we have in western Montana, because it's significant, and people really need to be aware of this, not only in western Montana, but throughout the country, because it does appear that this could easily have national implications. My background, a little bit of information on that. I live in western Montana within the exterior boundaries of the Flathead Indian Reservation and have been here for about 6 years. The water rights issue had pretty much been off the radar for me for quite a while. Even though I knew in the background that it was going on, I wasn't overly aware of it until recently I saw an article in the Missoula Independent talking about the water rights compact, and it piqued my curiosity. So I started to investigate the issue a little bit more, and I discovered that it truly is a big deal. And what was so surprising to me is that this negotiation has been taking place for more than 10 years. It has been pretty much under the radar. They're getting ready to wrap up this compact within the next few months, and they're trying to get it through our Montana legislature in 2013. And what was surprising about that was that the media has done nothing to inform people about this compact. Our local representatives haven't, and neither has the compact commission itself. So in an effort to try to get people talking about this issue, we decided to hold a town hall meeting, and that's kind of how we got started with this process. We held the town hall meeting in June. We invited a representative from the tribe, the federal government, and the state of Montana to join us. And during that town hall meeting, I think we had about 250 people attend, and which is a pretty good showing for rural Montana. And we showed an informational DVD to give people just a basic understanding, because we thought a lot of people wouldn't even understand the reason why the water rights were being negotiated. And then we actually only had one of those three negotiators attend that meeting, and that was Chris Tweeten, the state of Montana. So it was a pretty good meeting, and since that time we've got quite a big movement going, and we have an awful lot of people talking about this issue. So with that, I don't know, do you want me to go into...
Terry, I think it would be great for our listeners to get a little bit of the history as to why this compact is even being negotiated. And if you could briefly cover that, I think that'd be great.
Yeah, I was just this is Kate. I was just going to fill that gap, because Terry, your outline that you sent to us, I think you ought to just go ahead with that. But essentially, Indian water rights are based on treaties, And the volume of water, what it's a federal reserved water right. And what it basically is that when the United States sets aside a reservation, and that could be a Forest Service or also, in this case, Indian lands, it impliedly set aside an amount of water sufficient to fulfill the purpose of the reservation. And so litigation started on these water rights really in the early 1960s to try to quantify how much water that was. And the discussion has revolved around what is the purpose of the reservation. It's usually been agriculture. As you know, these are how the treaties were set up and so forth and so on. So the issue becomes then, in a litigation standpoint, determining the amount of water to fulfill the purpose of the reservation. And if it's irrigation, is to determine the amount of water sufficient to fill that need. Montana decided to take a different approach rather than litigation, which is can be very, very expensive and literally last, you know, a dozen years or more and spend everybody out. And Montana decided to set up, through Montana's own law, a compact system where the state would negotiate with the tribes and the United States to come up with some kind of compact. So that's the context. And Terry, really not only the background, but basically you just let someone know a big piece of this compact, which basically seems like the state and the tribes are negotiating in the dark. So Terry found out about this and then proceeded to organize from there. So go ahead, Terry, and from where you want to go.
Okay. They typically hold monthly meetings concerning the water compact, and one of the things that was striking about that is that, Kate said, they're kind of behind the scenes, because these meetings are held typically, even though they're supposedly public meetings, they're held early in the morning when most people have to work and can't make the meetings, and they're held in a tribal venue typically, and it's intimidating. You only need to go to one of those meetings to understand what I mean by that. It's in the seat of power of the tribe, I guess. My first experience at a compact meeting was at the Tribal Chamber Council, and that's their seat of power. And it was very intimidating to go into that setting and to listen to the elders talk about how they have been treated badly over the years, and that these water rights are very important, and they are not going to bend with regard to what is on the table concerning the water rights. And I'd like to just quickly go over what is on the table with regard to the water rights, because as I said earlier, they are very significant. And most people think that because this compact is being negotiated on the Flathead Indian Reservation, that this is the problem that exists only within the boundaries of the reservation, but that could not be further from the truth. The tribe is, let me start with what's being requested off reservation in Montana. They're asking for time immemorial in-stream flow rights for nearly every major stream and tributary throughout western Montana. And what's frightening about that is there are a lot of most people off reservation aren't even aware that those water rights are on the table, and that their rights will become junior to the tribe if this compact goes through as it's being negotiated. And what that represents is all it could take is an environmental issue, an endangered species, or some reason to increase those in-stream flows, and the other water users could have their water curtailed in lieu of that in-stream flow for that environmental reason. And you need to understand, in rural Montana, these tributaries and streams represent the lifeblood of the economy throughout western Montana. And if those water rights get curtailed because of the in-stream flow, it could effectively destroy the property values throughout western Montana and harm the economy greatly. And on the reservation, they're asking for 1855, which is the Hellgate Treaty date, or time immemorial water rights for all surface and groundwater on the Flathead Indian Reservation. On the reservation, we have what we call a Flathead Irrigation Project that also is the lifeblood of this area. And they're asking for the water rights for the irrigation project to become tribal water rights. And in exchange for that, the tribe will provide part of their settlement money for when the compact is settled. They'll get significant settlement money from the federal and the state governments. They will use some of that money for improvements in the project and for measurement devices on the project, and what they call a farm turnout allotment of 1.4 acre feet of water to the irrigators, and that's a flat 1.4 for every irrigator. So that's pretty significant because there are a lot of irrigators that are telling us that they will not be able to survive with that 1.4 acre foot allotment of water. So they're basically asking to control, for the most part, all of the water here on the Flathead Indian Reservation as well. And also through that, there are a couple other significant things that are going on with regard to the compact. They're, in addition to asking for the water right, there are also a couple of documents on the table that are extremely important part of this process. One of which is quite disturbing, it's called the Unitary Management Ordinance. And this document is... it was proposed by the tribe, and it's asking that the state approve this document that will take develop a unitary management board that would manage all water rights within the boundaries of the Flathead Indian Reservation, both tribal and non-tribal. And what's significant about that document is that it has the very likely potential of putting non-tribal residents on the reservation under a tribal authority for their water. And that's a huge issue for the people that live here on the reservation. And one of the biggest problems with it is that if you look at the demographics of the Flathead Indian Reservation, we have 28,000 people in total that live within the boundaries of the reservation, of which 23,000 are non-tribal and 5,000 are tribal. So if you can imagine, people are wondering, first of all, how much water 5,000 people need in the first place, but how we have the potential to be put under a tribal authority with regard to our water rights and no longer under state law as a result of that unitary management ordinance. And it's frightening to me that that ordinance is even being considered as part of this compact.
Let me interject just a little bit. This would be the first time in history and in the first place in the United States that a single tribe would be given jurisdiction over non-tribal members. And that becomes extraordinarily difficult because there's all a bunch of case law that doesn't really allow that. But by sneaking through in a compact way, this is what they've been able to do. Now, Terry, I think this is a good point to raise the issue where what did you learn from the Compact Commission of the state basically giving up jurisdiction or authority, in other words, throwing its own residents away?
They pretty much agree that that's what they're doing, which is pretty astounding, especially when you hear hear that from the people that you thought were at the table to protect your water rights. And that was a mistaken assumption that I made going into this. I assumed that the Montana Constitution would protect me and that any negotiations, because that's what they're calling them, that are taking place would have representatives at the table that would be protecting my water rights. But that's not the premise with which they used to sit at the table. At one of the compact meetings, a member of the public asked the question, if the Compact Commission had ever considered the financial cost associated with the diminishment of water rights for the people of Western Montana as a result of the compact. And they didn't even blink an eye. The answer was no, because you never had the rights in the first place. They've always belonged to the tribes. So to me, that was like a punch in the stomach. That was the first time I realized that they were not at the table to protect everyone's water right, even though their talking points often say that the tribe has made a concession, they're going to protect all existing uses of water. That really is... Those are talking points. That's not really what's happening with regard to the negotiations. And then the other eye opener to answer Dr. Kate's question, at a Helena meeting just this past week, Chris Tweeten, the chair of the Compact Commission, during a discussion concerning the Unitary Management Ordinance, he stated that if the tribe pushes back because someone mentioned in the meeting that the tribes are going to be complaining that the state is trying to curb their requests a little bit too much and they're not going to be happy with that, Mr. Tweeten said, well, we will have to remind the tribes about the grand bargain that we made with them where an extraordinary concession was made by the state. We agreed to remove non-tribal rights from under state jurisdiction in exchange for their agreement to protect existing verified uses of water. That was pretty stunning to hear. And I wrote it down, and when I was able to ask questions, we had to wait till the end of the meeting to ask questions. I reread that to him and asked him if that's what he said, and he said yes. That's what he said. And then he realized what I was asking, and he tried to backtrack from that a little bit and say, well, you might be interpreting that a little bit too broadly. But in all honesty, his response from that point forward was lost on me because he basically told me he'd given my rights away. They bargained our rights away in this compact in exchange for the talking point that they would protect existing uses of water.
Terry, on two points. One, is Tweeten's remark or the fact that Montana gave up its jurisdiction over non-tribal water rights, is that constitutional according to Montana's constitution?
No, it's not. The Constitution says that Montana owns the water and the state is required to administer and protect the water rights for the people. So, no, this is not constitutional. But they're still entertaining it, and that's quite shocking.
And the second point is some of the mechanics of what you've seen as part of these documents. Is that it appears that the amount of water that is going to be given to the farm turnouts, 1.4 acre feet per acre, is about an acre foot lower than it has historically been. So what you have the prospect of is shortchanging the irrigators, moving irrigator water to let me see if I can get this right, and Terry, please correct me. Shorting the irrigators of an 1855 water right and basically taking other water and turning it into a time immemorial in-stream flow right.
Yes, that's correct. And yes, they're using a document that's called the Stipulation Agreement, which is the state is maintaining is a private agreement between the tribes and the Flathead Irrigation Project and the federal government to be able to accomplish that. And I just like to mention at this point, this purely, plain and simple, to me, is a redistribution of wealth, because what will happen with this process is that once the rancher's allotment of water has been reached, they're going to have to watch that water flow downstream because all the measurement devices, all of that will be there, and they will not be able to use more than their allotment. So once they have to watch it go downstream, they're going to have to curtail their existing operations based upon the new water allotment and reduce their income. And in turn, the tribe's going to be able to actually lease that water right and increase their income. So that's a huge problem, and people need to see this for exactly for what it is. It is a redistribution of wealth and control.
Lady,
it's a big redistribution of power as well.
Ladies, for those few of us who have some understanding of water rights, which I don't know how much of an understanding our listeners have, I'm curious as to whether or not this involves renewable surface rights or non-renewable aquifer rights or a combination of both. What are we talking about?
It's both. And I want to point out a major feature. No reservation in the United States has any tribe been given a, quote, reserved water right to groundwater. What has happened, it appears to me, and again, Terry, please confirm, but it seems like all of this work has been negotiated in private, and there has been no, quote, quantification, determination of the amount of surface water and the amount of groundwater that the tribe is entitled to. It is basically, we're going to give the non-Indians this, and then we're taking the rest. And so those are 2 points there. Terry, your view.
That's absolutely correct. To the best of our knowledge, when they're pressed concerning the quantification, they tell us it's being done. There's been nothing provided by the tribes, the federal government, or the state concerning the actual process of quantifying the tribe's water. Instead, what we're hearing is that they have been going through the process of quantifying the non-tribal water right throughout the reservation and through, I'm assuming that maybe even in other parts of western Montana. And the idea is to whatever's left is going to belong to the tribe when this is all done. And so they're going to back into the tribal amount as opposed to quantifying what specifically is needed to fulfill the purpose of the reservation.
Well, lady, I just kind of want to interject for a moment. What we've seen and witnessed and have actually proven here on Walls in Our Minds with direct testimony of, you know, experts in various situations is that in all of these circumstances, almost all of them, whether it's to do with the wolves in Montana or the Klamath River in California and Oregon, or whatever, I mean, when they've come in and tried to take control of these things, they've won, not represented the people, but they've also brought forth false science, false data. You can't rely on the data that the government comes out with if they did quantify it. Are you running into any of that, Terry?
As a matter of fact, we are. There's a lot that's wrong with the documentation that is associated with these documents. Let's start with the fact that they have not taken into consideration the customary history and uses of the irrigation project, the soils, the differing soils here within the irrigation project, and the differences are quite significant, as well as the amounts of natural rain and moisture in different parts of the reservation. It's dramatically different from the mountain area as opposed to like our Hot Springs or Camas area, which are significantly drier and get a lot less rainfall. So they're giving just a flat allotment. They're They're using, I think, I'm not sure what university, but a university study as the foundation or the basis to determine the allotment. And there are a lot of irrigators that are questioning the science behind this because there have been actual studies that have been done here, but they didn't reference those when they came up with the science for this. And I also believe that there are some problems with the way they developed the in-stream flow numbers. And Dr. Kate, you might be able to speak to that a little better than me.
Well, I find it just extraordinary. You know, the whole modeling of water, surface and groundwater interactions is a very tricky deal. And when you add on top of that, whether you have a drought year or a normal year, or a surplus water year, that the water conditions completely change. And depending on the winter you have and the antecedent soil moisture conditions, it is quite variable. Apparently, the consultant that they used or the university they used to do these studies basically used a model that is sufficient only for main stem, looking at the main stem of a river. It is not sufficient to actually turn that water into a field and see what happens when that water goes on field. In other words, they don't have to do what Terry was talking about, looking at the whether you have sand or clay or a mixture or a rocky soil. As you all know, it's important. Plus, whatever the crop needs, you have to add a certain amount of water to basically get the water to the field. Now imagine you're on the end of a canal, and you've got, you know, a few acres. You've got to push an enormous amount of water down that canal to basically get to the water that you need. So these things cannot be included in this model. It's called HYDROSS, HYDROSS. It's a typical Bureau of Reclamation model that cannot be used to determine the fine points of what each farmer turns out. The second piece about in-stream flow. In-stream flow is a very tricky business to determine that. You know, the fish are at different stages. They're in their life cycle, and at each different stage, they have a water need, temperature as well as water quality, and of course they have a habitat need of substrate and things like that. Well, we don't even know what fish are being protected. Sure, there's trout, but what else? We don't know what volume of waters are being requested for each of those life stages. We have, or at least not we, but basically I don't see any technical work that's been done to determine the amount of water required for in-stream flow on the reservation. And lastly, there seems to be a claim for in-stream flow in the very irrigation ditches themselves. Now, that's not a normal fishing spot for everybody, except when the water gets shut off in the fall. You can go get a bunch of fish that have gotten into the canal. But to now claim that an in-stream flow habitat is in actually an irrigation ditch is, you know, it's just massive grabbing of water is what I would say. So in terms of the intricacies of, in my view, looking at surface groundwater actions, the actual requirements of the field for irrigation, they're just nowhere near the analysis of that and so forth. And the interesting thing is if they were in litigation, if this was being litigated, all of these things would be ordered by a judge. You have to quantify that. If you're going to claim an in-stream flow, you have to quantify it. I know in plenty of places where I've worked, we've tried to quantify. We've thought we've quantified an in-stream flow. We've claimed an in-stream flow, but we've never been successful, really, in claiming that as part of the, again, original purpose of the reservation. So there is no end point to the taking of water here. Like I said, it looks like the irrigators are going to get X amount, and the tribes are just going to get the rest, depending on what kind of, or generally and irrespective of what kind of water year proceeds. So it is it is wholly inadequate, and I'm very proud of to understand from some of the irrigators who have been really technically looking at this, and of course the irrigators have all the experience. They're better than the universities because they have lived out there and they know what the situation is with their fields and so forth. But on every count that's been looked at, none of what's being proposed in this stipulation agreement with the irrigators, the tribes in the United States, is effective. And they think that by offering the irrigators an 1855 water right, you know, when you're in the West, it's, you know, the first person gets the water, the earliest water user gets the right. So most states have the date of their water rights when the state was actually formed. Here there are 1855 water rights, which predate the state, but like I say, the water appears to be being shifted to in-stream flow with a time immemorial date. So that means when it's dry or even normal, like Terry said, the irrigators are going to have to watch that water go by because it's got a time immemorial water right for fisheries, which has not really been scientifically identified.
Does that answer?
Did I stop all conversation or what?
I didn't know if Terry wanted to follow up comment to that.
I mean, did that answer your question, Terry Dodd?
Yes. It answered mine. I'm not sure where we go from here with all of that technical information. I guess, you know, we need to figure out here how we deal with this sort of situation. I mean, it's a I know you may not even want to put out all of your plans or anything for how you deal with something like this, but this is huge. I mean, we're talking about this almost calmly, but we're talking major effects to people's lives, and we're dealing with 10th Amendment issues here. We're dealing with state representatives who are not living up to the oath of their offices. We're dealing with a negotiation that's probably being negotiated without the proper data or for even the right reasons. And the people that are negotiating it, some of them shouldn't even be involved in the negotiation at all. This is extremely disturbing, and I guess I'm wanting to hear, you know, Terry, what are you getting as feedback from people up there? Are people willing to rise up and take action against this, or are they just still sitting there with the remote controls watching the Broncos tonight?
Well, it's really quite an interesting mix, to answer your question. We've got, I guess, in our politically correct climate, I guess, that we find ourselves in, not just here in Montana, in western Montana, but throughout the country, there are a lot of people that just plain and simple don't want to be involved because it has to do with the tribe. And they don't want to be perceived as speaking out against the tribe. So that's a very difficult issue for people to have to deal with. So there's a segment of folks that just won't speak out about it, even though they're concerned about it. And then we do have some other segments of the population. As I said earlier, we think that for the most part, this has been so under the radar within reservation boundaries as well as throughout western Montana. It's a huge challenge for us to awaken people to this so that they are aware of it. And it's actually my understanding that the Compact Commission did not do a very good job of notifying the off-reservation people that the water rights were on the table with this compact until very late in the game. So it's only been recently that they've even been aware that like the Kootenai River up in northwestern Montana, very northwestern part of Montana, is being negotiated as part of this, at least some of the water rights from it. So it's kind of a massive effort to notify off and on reservation. We're a pretty big state. It's, you know, it doesn't take long to have to travel a far distance just to get to the next town, and it's rather difficult. And the other piece of it that we believe is extremely important is because, as Dr. Kate said, so much of this is unprecedented. They've taken the broadest perspective in the interpretation of their treaties with the Winters Rights and the Stevens Treaty Rights, that it's mind-boggling when you think about what they have on the table, and that it's even being entertained. But if they are successful and these things become part of this compact, we believe that water rights throughout the country, or at least here in the western part of the United States, will be reopened and renegotiated for similar terms. So this really should be something that's getting national coverage, but unfortunately it's not. We barely get an article in the local newspapers, and when we do, it's clear that these people have not done their homework. They really only know, they'll ask a few questions, and they'll basically regurgitate the talking points of the Compact Commission. So it's a very difficult task that we have. We do have some organization of the irrigators. They are starting to speak out, and they actually are, I believe they have retained an attorney to form an LLC to represent the irrigators with regard to the stipulation agreement. And I'm not very familiar with exactly what their legal strategy is. I just know that they're going through the process of doing that. As far as other people, at this point in time, I find it fascinating because most people, when they go to the compact meetings, they're aware there's a water rights problem. They're concerned about it, but all they want to know about is their well. And yeah. I understand, you know, that people, you know, they want to know, how is this going to impact me? So they have these blinders on, and they have this tendency to just want to know. And once they say, well, we're going to protect existing uses of water, and your well's not going to be impacted, so go back to sleep. And a lot of people, I think, are, well, okay, this compact must not be a bad deal. If they're going to protect my existing uses of water and my well is going to be fine, what's the big deal? Well, the big deal is that they're not looking at the bigger picture of this, and the fact that he who controls the water controls the people. They control the property values. They control the economy. They control your ability to earn a living off of your land. So they control your property rights. It's a huge overreach any way you look at this in terms of wealth, power, control. It's very difficult. And we're just, as I said, we're only just getting started with this process. They've had a 10-year head start on us. And we're just now trying to get the word out to people to make them aware. But the good news is we are making a difference. People are listening. They are talking about it. And we're doing everything that we can to get educational material out to them. And we're going to start doing a series of town hall meetings throughout western Montana, because there are 11 counties that will be impacted by this. And we want to make sure that they're aware of this, and that they will ally with us if we have to take this to the if we have to go to the legislature to fight this in 2013.
Well, we're getting a lot of comments in our chat, but before we get to those, I wanted to give Kurt McKenzie, he is here with us, and I wanted to give him a live mic, Kate. He's got to leave here in about just 5 or 6 minutes, and I wanted to make sure that any questions that he had, he was able to get in before he goes.
Well, thanks, Kurt, Ray. I appreciate it. Yeah, can you hear me okay?
Do. You go for it.
Yeah, this is a serious issue, and it's another example, I think, of just hundreds or thousands of these across the nation. It's probably one of the more egregious ones, but, you know, it's the same problem that I see over and over again, and that is that, you know, an attitude, it doesn't affect me or whatever, and you sit back and, you know, you're trusting government's doing something for you, and in fact what you discover is not. and we do nothing to prepare for these things. We do nothing to prepare an organizational structure. We do nothing to build the communicate, coordinate, and cooperate systems, the alliances, the things, you know, that have to happen. And then you discover a problem at the, you know, when they're on the 99th yard line just in Siskiyou County. And, you know, here's Terry and a few people trying to figure out how do you reach the masses and change minds and organize a response. The thing we have got to realize across the country is this is not a local problem. This is a national problem. It affects us nationally. And we have got to realize that we have got to prepare and put those coalitions in place now before it gets to be to this kind of a stage. And in a last-ditch effort like this, it really takes the kind of the money and the skills to help to mobilize public opinion, because it's not going to be your representatives that are going to solve this problem. They're part of the problem. And the courts, frankly, I think attorneys will make a ton of money, and it's probably something that will probably be done. My guess is it's not going to work out. And so I think that really the court of public opinion is where you have to get to, and need to have a very simple KISS message to these people that are going to be impacted, and figure out where their, you know, properties are, what zip codes are in, and so forth, and actually get out maps to show them exactly how it's going to impact them, and then get them to come to these meetings like I know that Terry is doing. And then at those meetings, you've got to capture their names, phone numbers, email addresses. You need to capture, in my opinion, their city, their county, their zip code, so you can actually begin to build a network of communications so that you can mobilize people, kind of like, you know, having the lantern in the tower. If you just have events, have a presentation, have a discussion, everybody walks away and nobody knows how to contact each other, it doesn't work. So it's certainly interesting to hear Dr. Kate on the show tonight. I know this is an area of expertise for her. I would say that what's becoming clearer to me, when I got involved in the Siskiyou County story, there was a Native Indian tribal issue involved, which I kind of figured was local to the problems there. And as I begin to look at all these property right issues, water right issues, timber issues, mining issues across the country, what I'm beginning to discover is this tribal issue is attached to not necessarily all, but a good proportion, a great majority of these situations. And it's kind of my thesis, closing in on my conclusion, that this is a lot like gambling in the United States, where you have the people that control the gambling industry that figured this stuff out, and they went out to the tribes and they pulled the tribes in and kind of co-opted the tribes in order to extend gambling and get it throughout our nation, and brought gambling back to what used to be a Christian country that prohibited that. And, you know, gambling is probably one of the ways that you take money from people, and people lose out. So in any case, it was an organized effort at a nucleus spanning out to all these tribes to do it with gambling. And I think what's going on right now is that there is a centralized control, and they're spanning out and doing this one more time with all the natural resources in our country. And I'm talking not just water. I'm talking water, of course, means food. I'm talking about water, timber, mining, you know, the things, the backbone of our posterity. And we're talking perpetual rights here. I mean, for infinity. So it's a huge displacement, and I think that everybody really needs to take it seriously.
Well, Kurt, before you split on us, do you have any specific questions or things that you'd like to see Terry cover here tonight?
Well, I think that the, my whole thing, I've talked to Terry offline. I think that there has to be a whole program put together, frankly, to address.
I think they're doing that.
Well, I think that's absolutely essential. But I think that the message has to be really simple. And you can add complexity to the message, but don't confuse the fact you better have a punchline and make it a one-liner and make sure that you repeat that many, many times throughout a presentation. Because if you get lost in this technical analysis and, you know, laws back in and there and whatever else, the audience is going to get lost. and what they're going to retain in their mind is something simple, and you want to make sure you control the simple thing that they take away with them when they, you know, leave the meeting.
Yes, as a matter of fact...
Go right ahead, please.
As a matter of fact, we have done that to some great extent, and we are working on developing a series of talking points, very specific, that will get the point across and keep us on message, because one of the things that we discover is that the commission has been through many, many compacts. So they've been through this, done this, and they know how to stop the debate, and that's what they do with their talking points. So we want to make sure that we're discrediting the talking point, their talking points, but also have our own that keep bringing people back to the very key specific issues related to this so that they can understand it in a simple way. So I don't disagree with what you're saying. I do think that we've made a lot of progress in that area.
Well, I'm glad to hear it. Keep it down. Get one punchline, though, at the bottom of the line here. You want to have simple message, but have a single punchline. Listen, I'm going to drop off, but, you know, phenomenal that you guys are talking about this, and I hope that there's a big audience tonight listening in because, you know, if it's not in your backyard yet, you probably just aren't aware of it because it's probably there and going on behind closed doors.
Well, thank you, Kirk, and God bless.
Okay, thanks.
So, Terry, Kate, did you, we haven't let Red Beckman get in here. He's our resident Montanan here on the host side tonight. So I think we need to get Red's thinking on this. And, you know, I was listening to Kurt about his punchline situation. And I remember back before the beginning of this year when we were doing shows on the Klamath River and some other issues, where we spent a lot of time answering technical questions and listening to the false science, and I really felt like the message was getting lost in that. So I have some appreciation for what Kirk said, and I think it's good advice, and I think you guys are already on track with that, though. I mean, I'm looking at what you're doing and the way you're talking about this, and I think you're going to relate very well to the people. But it's just like Bob said in our chat here, who is apparently a part of your group up there. He says we need some bucks, we need some brochures, we need some DVDs, we need to get the word out on this thing, and that's really where it lies. You've just got to be able to reach the people. Red, are you ready to make a comment on this?
I would rather be a good listener. there's so many things that play into this. Now, I have been quite aware of what has been happening on the reservations. I could tell you some stories, but I don't dare because it would take days to tell you all the stories I know about the Indians and their problems with the federal government. You know, I'm not going to try to propose a solution. I don't know what the situation is there on the Flathead Indian Reservation, but I know that some of the reservations, if a person has a sixteenth. Like the Crow tribe, if you've got a 16th of Crow blood in your line, in your pedigree, you can be a tribal member. I know what happens because I was there involved in some of this a long time ago, and the real, the troublemakers on the reservations, for the most part, will be basically white people with a trace, a very small trace usually, of Native American blood in their veins. And I remember some very, very well how that they were just out to make trouble, and they were enjoying it. But for them, it was a recreation project to cause trouble. So this is one thing that feeds into this, that you've got to keep this in the back of your mind. And, of course, someone has mentioned the lawyers, and the lawyers, if they were to get all of the lawyers out of the picture, it would probably be possible to sit down and work this thing out in a reasonable and proper way. Lawyers make money off of contention and such, and that's a motivating force for them, is to cause a lot of tension, a lot of pressure in a lot of different ways. And so there's so much, and there's another thing, and of course I have said it for a long time, and I am so convinced that the federal government that we have today is really not the government that was created by the Constitutional Convention and the installation of the Constitution as the supreme law of our land. And I don't think that this government that we have today is going to survive. And I've said it many a time. I've talked about the federal God. And because basically the Roe v. Wade decision, the decision to take the Bible out of the public school classroom and all of this, the federal government has violated the first commandment that God gave to the children of Israel. And that was, thou shalt not have any other God before the true God. And, of course, the second commandment, he said that God is a jealous God. And I'm convinced of that, and I'm convinced that the reason the USSR is now history and that system has been thrown on the junk heap of history is because they were in violation of God's laws. And so, sure, there's going to be the ACLU people say, oh, you can't talk about that. But I do anyway, because the ACLU, I think, is a poor, whether they're an organized voice for disunity, I think. And I can say a lot about them. But Western Montana has so much. In the way of beautiful scenery and climate, and it's just it's a great place. I've jokingly said, I've told people many a time that the Flathead Valley is probably going to be the closest to heaven that a lot of them get, because it is a great, great area. You know, there's been a lack of local and personal participation in so much. They were able to pull off the wolf scam without the people standing up and saying no. They didn't do it, and what a price they've had to pay. And, of course, it was bad science and all kinds of things, and bad politics, of course. But my hat is off to Terry. I wish her the best, because I used to know a lot of those people in that area. I ran for governor in 1988, and some of my strongest supporters were over from the Flathead Valley. And we did a lot of meetings up there, and I can tell you some kind of funny stories about some of the things that we had happen back there, and, you know, 20 years or so ago. And the state law enforcement, they went out and raided a bunch of the bars around Flathead Lake. And they had a kid that he was a teenager yet, but he looked like he was 10 years older, and he looked like a logger, and he was going into these bars and buying booze and such, and then the law would swoop in and gather up the bartenders and everything, and they did that with they had quite a process, and they started at Polson and went north on both sides of the lake. And they asked me to come up and do a session, and I did about 2 or 3 hours on a local television station or radio station in Kalispell, and explaining the principle of jury nullification and jury power. And I didn't know that I had been brought in on this brouhaha. And but anyway, afterwards I found out, and the state attorney general's office and such, they prosecuted the first case in Polson, and they lost it because the jury had become informed, and they said no. And all of those cases, and I don't remember how many there were, but there was a whole string of them. And they just had to throw them all away because they knew they couldn't get the people to say guilty. So it's entirely possible to educate the people out there. It's what we've got is a failure of our education system. And boy, I tell you, Kurt is right. I think, you've got to have the right kind of pitch to put out there for people. But when they get hurt, when they get threatened, they do wake up. And let's hope that happens, because the Flathead Valley is a poor place for a revolution. I'd hate to see that happen. And, of course, I don't think it'll go that far, but we have to realize if the Agenda 21 people are in there and some of these other scalawags, they're not going to go and disappear into the woodwork where they belong. But, Terry, you've got my respect, and hang in there, and if you run into some people that remember Red Beckman, why, tell them I'm still kicking.
Will do. Thank you. You know, that reminds me of another whole piece of this that gets pretty little coverage. And, you know, I mentioned earlier the demographics of the Flathead Reservation, where the tribe only makes up 15% of the population within reservation boundaries. And that presents a whole different dynamic compared to most other reservations. I know that there are some other open reservations, but we have a significant non-tribal population here. And that in 1904, I think it was, the federal government opened the reservation up to the settlers to come in. So they passed the Allotment Act, the Flathead Allotment Act, and they allotted lands to the tribes. And then once all of the tribe, every tribal member had their allotment of land, they opened up the reservation for non-tribal settlement. And that is a huge elephant in the room. I think there is a lot of resentment by the tribe with the fact that the reservation was open because the Hell Gate Treaty says that the reservation will be for the exclusive use of the tribe. And they're very resentful of the fact that the federal government opened it up. But that's on the one hand. But on the other hand, the potential is, or actually it's not potential, the fact is that the federal government invited non-tribal settlers to come here onto the reservation, and they told them nothing about the Hell Gate Treaty and the water rights, and that their water rights somewhere down the road would be compromised because of the Hell Gate Treaty and the Winters Decision, the Winters Decision took place in 1908, so about the time the settlers were coming in, about 1910 or so, that decision had already been made. And so the question becomes in our minds is, when we understand that the federal government was not necessarily always fair to the tribes, and they did a lot of bad things. But on the other hand, they also defrauded the non-tribal people that came here onto the reservation, who purchased their land or took the allotment of land without ever understanding the implications of the water rights. So we have this whole big mess that the federal government has created here on the reservation, and they've never had the political courage to fix what was done. For example, when the Allotment Act, we believe that when the Allotment Act, the Flathead Allotment Act was passed, and the 1924 Indian Citizenship Act was passed, the Flathead Indian Reservation went away. It should have been diminished because of those circumstances, and yet the commission pretends that that never happened, and they sit at the table saying, nope, state treaty exists as it did in 1855, and the tribes always had that water right.
Boy, and I would say that is so overly broad, but also so typical of the United States to essentially set up a conflict and then run out the door when it's been partially, quote-unquote, resolved. So this is huge. I don't know if everyone fully understands this. And, I agree with Kirk in terms of keeping it simple, but I also have strong backing for Terry Bax and the group that's working there, because they're nailing down some of the issues. And the difficulty of keeping it simple, stupid, and having a slogan in this situation is precisely because they've set it up in a way to be very complex. There are three documents. One is the stipulation between the tribes, the irrigators, and the United States that basically affects everybody on and off reservation. The second document is this big unitary management ordinance, which puts everybody under a political board that basically won't have any requirements to be technically oriented and so forth. And then third, they have the compact, which after all these compacts done in Montana, the compact commission is tired, and it seems like with anything that you've been doing a long time, you sort of forget who you're supposed to be representing. This is a wholesale abandonment of state citizens, which is unnecessary because the supposed benefit is that, quote unquote, the tribes will protect the non-Indian water rights. Well, what do you think about that? I don't think that's going to happen. Terry, I wanted to ask you, there are a couple of things that seem to be floating around that the government, the federal government, also the state government, are kind of using to try to push people into a corner. One of those is money, and the other is the threat of litigation. Could you talk about how those two things have been used to kind of divide the community and to, again, mislead on the major issues that are at stake?
Sure. But before I do that, I just want to mention, in terms of a slogan, I don't know. I think Terry sent out a brochure earlier, and we actually have a newer version of that, but we're basically saying, got water, how about the right to use it? Because they're two different things. You might have all kinds of water passing through your property, but you might not have the right to use it. So we are trying to get the message across in a variety of different ways, and we have come up with some very simple PowerPoint narrative presentations that we're using as well on that. So to the talking points that Dr. Kate was talking about, as we mentioned earlier, one of the biggest ones is that they're protecting our existing uses of water, but they never want to talk about the future uses of water. And the problem with that is that they're going to, the potential exists with this unitary management ordinance that if you go to this administration board, which I never did explain the makeup of that board, but it's set up to have two tribal appointments, two governor appointments, and those four people would pick a fifth person. And this is why we see this as becoming a tribal board, because the likelihood is that that will be the case. We have an example of that right here on the reservation with the cooperative management entity for the Flathead Irrigation Project, and it has a makeup of four tribal, four joint board members, and then a ninth person, I guess, that's picked by the other eight. And it pretty much is a tribal board as well. So, as I said, we have a living example of that. But that board would be who you would go to if you wanted to put in a new well or an existing use of water. And the potential exists that there could be bias with that board. There could be problems that would hold up for a significant period of time your ability to develop new uses of water on your land, et cetera. And so they're not talking about the mitigation that would be required for future uses of water, which could stifle development because of expensive development costs associated with mitigation. And then they talk about the exempt wells, as I mentioned earlier, and that gives people the impression that if their well's exempt, then the compact's okay, so that's a big problem. And then they tell us that their constant mantra is if you don't accept the compact, no matter how unacceptable it is, you're going to have to hire a lawyer or you're going to have to bone up on your legal skills and defend your water rights. We're going to have to go to litigation if we are unable to do this by a compact, and that's something you don't want to do. Well, that's okay. That's a good reason to go to the table and negotiate. We believe that you don't want to go to litigation if you can avoid it. However, that can't be, it's almost to the point, you hear it so often that it's considered to be coercion in my mind, because it's making people settle for less than what they deserve. This compact is by no means a fair and equitable compact as I see it laying out on the table. Now, I will mention to you that it's very difficult to actually say that, in a completely factual way, because if you go look at the documents that are out there, they're very incomplete, they're very ambiguous. So it's really hard to see what's on the table with regard to our rights because we don't have complete documents to take a look at. But people become divided by virtue of the fact that even within people that are opposed or concerned about the compact, they will say, oh, we need to settle for what they're giving us because it's the best deal that we're going to be able to get. And then there are other people that want to fight this through litigation. So that's a huge problem, and we think that talking point really needs to go away because it isn't doing anything. What it does is it stifles the debate. People won't speak out about it because they think their only option is to go to litigation, and that's not the case. We just want to make sure that we believe that the tribe deserves water rights. We believe everyone deserves water rights. And whatever the agreement ends up being, it needs to be fair and equitable for everyone.
Thank you, Terry. I just wanted to also raise raise this litigation threat as basically something that's a bluff. Because if the United States had to go to litigation on behalf of the tribes, they would have to quantify the tribal water right. And they would have to provide the basis, not just a treaty, but the technical basis for any in-stream flow claims. And they would not ever be able to, in a litigation context, be able to give this over to an appointed political board when you should be having actual technical water managers with a, you know, with a determined plan and so forth and so on. So I know that I've said several times, call their bluff, because I've seen the other side of this. I've seen what litigation is about and how much work it is. And, yeah, it's real expensive. But it's also, you know, the threat is being used as if the people would lose. And, again, from my standpoint, no, this is at some point that bluff may need to be called. The second piece that I think is also the money issue is, you know, there are some of the non-tribal irrigators who are saying, oh, let's go for it. The money's really good on this. And they're promising, quote, billions of dollars. Well, we know in this time right now we've got foreign money coming in. Flathead has oil and gas reserves in their mountains as well as other resources, most likely. And the last big settlement was about $600 million, but that was on the Crow Reservation in southern Montana. So money is being used to basically waive requirements, in-stream flow requirements. You know, the people are being bought off with the vision of large sums of money. Now, anyone who's out there working right now knows, like, what money, you know, what the debt situation is and so forth. So it is another threat, empty threat in my view. But again, with the foreign money coming in, what is happening? Now, the possibility that the tribes could sell their water to anybody raises this concern again about Agenda 21 and a bit about the Carlyle Group and other groups that are coming purchasing large amounts of water as water rights for various other purposes. So I am quite concerned about that. I also have been on the other side in terms of the money situation, and I also believe that is a bluff too, unless we are talking about you know, the Turks or the Russians or the Chinese coming in and dumping money into the reservation. So I guess what I'm saying with this is that there's something else going on here that is totally covered up, and it's like you're running around hand-waving. You know, they are running around hand-waving with three impartial, not complete documents running around, a deadline of 2013 to submit this, the threats that if you don't sign this document, then the whole thing goes, we will have to litigate, you're going to spend all your money, you're going to lose. There's something else going on here underneath this. So you know, Terry, I just have a lot of admiration for you and what others are doing up there. And, you know, we've got to come together to find the right resources to assist. Now, Red had mentioned, you know, one just a very short picture, and with regard to the wolves, is one of the ways to stop the movement of reintroduction of wolves and so forth is to take it to the people or take it to a jury. And we probably don't have time to discuss this, but I think that might be an avenue. You know, Terry, I've been recommending it's time to enjoin the state and it's time to stop these guys and time to do something else. But there may be, I guess it's the court of public opinion, and there may be another interesting avenue parallel to the wolf situation that could be used to stop this in its tracks. Having looked at all three incomplete documents, I am very concerned, and I'm so glad that Terry is here this evening. So I guess I just wanted to pop in with those items.
Yeah. With regard to the incomplete documents, it's very interesting because right now they're trying to put forth the stipulation agreement. That's out there for public comment, or I guess they just recently closed the public comment period on it, and they're in the process of responding to those comments. They're going to hold a public meeting a little bit later this month, but each of these documents reference one another. So what in essence they're doing with the stipulation agreement, if it gets voted through before the other two documents, is that they're basically asking the people that vote that through to sign a blank check. It's like because they're having to approve a document that references two documents that they have no idea what's in them or what will be in the final outcome. And it's kind of like I have a friend that likens that to Nancy Pelosi saying, we have to pass Obamacare so we can find out what's in the bill. You know, it's kind of the same deal. So it's extremely frustrating to us to not be able to understand the whole thing. And I think the timing of whatever strategy plays on that, because you really don't know completely yet what the monster is that you're dealing with. So which head do you cut off, and is it a false head because you don't have all of the information out there in front of you? So yes, we're looking for strategies, we're looking for resources, we're looking for people that are willing to help us with this and to get the word out. We don't have all the answers, and I'm certainly by no means an expert on this. I've only, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, have only in the past 6 to 8 weeks started looking at this myself. So my learning curve has been very steep in trying to wrap my arms around it, and it's almost an impossible task.
Terry Dodd.
Yes,
can
I'm sorry, I was muted. Yes,
oh.
I do.
Okay.
There's
yeah,
a comment by our friend Jan in chat talking about the water courts and that the Montana Code calls for all water disputes to go through the water court. And that was the first thing that dawned on me. We have a state water board here in Colorado, and you know, all jurisdiction, as far as adjudicated water rights and everything, you know, goes through that water board, or you know, in the case in Montana, the water court. And I'm wondering, you know, how they feel about this. Why are they not being the ones that would be involved in determination of who gets to use the water and who owns what water rights? It seems like that would be the place for it. I recognize that it's no accident that, you know, as Red refers to them, the false federal god working through the tribes, because they can say that that's not under that same jurisdiction. The other thing that I would like for you ladies to consider, and Kate, I know that your vision of things has changed significantly over the years, and perhaps no more than they have in the last few years about a lot of things. And one of the things that we've been finding in all of these situations, whether it's the wolves or the Klamath River or the game and fish people or the spotted owls or, you know, Wildlands Project, you name it, all of these things seem to have, just like you said a while ago, Kate, but you didn't elaborate on it, a lot of hidden agendas. There's a lot of things that are behind the scene. And I know Red's still listening, and Red's talked so much about the pecking order and how that, you know, our republic was set up with God on top, the people next, then the Constitution, and then the government. And it seems like this group that wants to be gods, the ones that want to rule the world, the ones that want us to treat them like they're gods, have instituted this UN and this League of Nations approach, and they go out there and they attack you in so many different ways that there's no way that you can focus on just one thing. Are you going to spend your money, you know, on attorneys fighting a battle for water, or you know, they just get you consumed by all of these things. Yet the real purpose of this is to remove our unalienable rights, to negate the constitutions, both federal and state. And so I think we can't take our eye off of that. And again, I think you've got to put the message out in a simple fashion that the people are going to respond to it. But we're here having a conversation that's a little bit beyond that. And I think we have to recognize that there is a lot more going on here than just about water or economy. It really boils down to who's in charge. Is it God? Is it the people? Or is it the false gods? And I think that's really what's going on here. And I'd kind of like you ladies to maybe address that.
Well, your first comment concerning the water court. Yes, the Unitary Management Ordinance basically does away with the water court with regard to anyone that lives within the reservation boundaries. They will not have that as an option. So basically, we will be treated differently under the Montana Constitution than any other citizens in the state of Montana. But they justify this by saying that we're going to write as much of the Montana water law as we can into the unitary management, so hopefully it will be administered fairly similar way as the state of Montana. And we talked about the fact, well, that's fine, except that if you have a biased unitary management board, then you have a problem having it administered fairly, and you can't write bias into the law. You can't write it out of the law, rather. So that's kind of where that stands. They're basically saying, we're going to experiment with your rights, and this is one way for the tribe to this is something the tribe has tribes have constantly been doing. If you go back and you look at the history, they're trying to chip away a little bit at our sovereignty, a little bit at a time with all of these court cases, and sure enough, the courts allow them to do that. And concerning the bigger picture, certainly we see that it's a bigger picture. Understand this at a gut level, even though they might not be aware of Agenda 21 and what the UN's doing and all of this stuff, they still know at a gut level that something's not right, because they're asking questions at these compact meetings about, well, what is the tribe's position concerning future growth and development here? What is the plan? Once they get this control, what are they going to do with it? So they understand that there's something more here, but they don't really necessarily know what it is. But they are asking the questions, and they are very concerned about it, because they understand that this compact will not provide them certainty with regard to their water rights and their livelihood and their ability to live on this land, or for future generations to be able to live on this land. And just this week, I was talking to a man who's the chair of the Glen Lake Irrigation District up in Lincoln County, and he's been very successful. His name's Steve Curtis, in invoking coordination to fight the feds with some of the water rights issues they have up there. And he tells me that there's something that's going on. And it wasn't even on my radar until he mentioned it just this past week. There's something called the Columbia River Treaty that's being negotiated, and that's a big deal. And I know it's part of this bigger picture of turning us into a wildlands again here throughout western Montana and probably the better part of the western part of our country. So it is a big deal, and it definitely is a much more insidious and much bigger picture than just this water rights issue. And with that, Dr. Kate, I don't know what your thoughts might be.
Yeah, just a couple of things, and a great question, Terry and TC, Terry Dodd. Just a second, the elimination of of the Montana Water Court is very important, because in all disputes, you have to have a court of remedy. You have to be able to go somewhere for a remedy. And by eliminating the Montana Water Court, your only place you get to your remedy is this political board. And if that political board can't handle it, then the Montana Compact Commission, or it goes up to the state board. Nowhere does it go to a court of competent jurisdiction, even a tribal court. Or a state court. It does not go to a court, and that's illegal. Thank you for mentioning the treaty piece, because then this brings me back to stuff that I wrote a while ago about Satan and the New World Order. And essentially, if you eliminate God at the top of the pecking order and replace it with a federal God, and then have that federal God be pushing away individual rights and then negotiating an international agreement on the Columbia River, it pretty much shows you where this is all going. This is the New World Order agenda, is to eliminate and, you know, to confuse people on the ground by, you know, this is the same thing as, you know, if you say something against Obama, they accuse you of being a racist. Well, if you say something about this compact, they accuse you of being anti-Indian and, you know, redneck and, you know, so forth. And it's just charged with emotion. But what has happened here is that hasn't worked. People have actually figured this out ahead of time. And when people do that and they get back to the basics, then the right God ends up on top and common sense takes over. And the elimination of the lawyers and the elimination of the money and the elimination of any, you know, career goals of the Compact Commission, who would love to be the Montana water judges and so forth and so on, becomes very, very evident. Also, you've just got to wonder, I think there was an article that one of my readers put out about a description of the compacts in Montana and how they are all occurring this way, just quietly behind the scenes and then jammed down everybody's throat with nobody realizing what the implications are. And this is typical of what we've seen as the New World Order tries to move in and to take over whole watersheds and internationalize them, such that the local people and the Montana courts and the state constitutions don't make any difference. It's what the international law is. And, of course, if you're negotiating an international treaty on the Columbia, there are a lot of tributaries to the Columbia River, and some of them are right up there in northwestern Montana. So it, you know, you can see the larger picture kind of emerging here. Then Jan also pointed out in the chat that the Environmental Protection Agency is in there trying to talk people into putting in wetlands where they never were before. So it's a full-on assault that you can see in this microcosm of northwestern Montana. And, you know, I used to believe that reservations were really, you know, they really were set aside for the tribal people and that it was for them to become independent and sovereign and so forth and so on and to maintain their cultures and whatnot. Now, I guess either I'm cynical or maybe I'm awake, but it looks to me like the reservations were just a very convenient place that somebody would start putting in international stuff on reservations to basically eviscerate the local economies, the local community, the local common sense, where, as Red was saying, you just kick a lot of people out of the room and you can negotiate something like this that makes common sense and so forth. So this is a grand setting up of people against each other. Thank God for people like Terry Bax. You know, this is... Look at the work that we've posted that she's done and her group have done in the chat room. This is a lot of work to have been done and a very steep learning curve, and my hat is off again to you, Terry, for doing this. But what I'm trying to say, probably ineloquently, is this is a microcosm of what's going on in our entire country, and it happens to be around one of the most important resources, and that's water. And if we put God back on top of the pecking order, you would not have a unitary management ordinance, which is, you know, again, look at the deception. We know that water is connected to everything, and it does make sense to manage it, you know, manage its connections and so forth and so on, but that's just a name. So you say, I'm against this unitary management ordinance, you know, and the response is, well, you're a scientist, you're a watershed manager. You should know that all water is connected. Well, of course I do, but a unitary management ordinance proposed here just basically is just another way to, you know, to squish the individuality and human spirit and our system of governing and living. And it is designed to rub the situation raw. So this is, again, I don't know if I answered your question, Terry, but it's just another example of how far we have strayed from the proper pecking order.
Terry Bax, would you like to follow up that comment?
Well, I would just say I concur with all that she said. I only wanted to make one comment concerning the unitary management ordinance and the recourse. I don't believe it's written into the documents, but what they're telling us in the meetings is that the court of competent jurisdiction would be the federal district court out of Missoula. And I am told, I talked to an attorney just within the last couple of days, and we talked about that a little bit, and they told me that that means that that we have a real problem on our hands, because the way the law's written, all they can do is review the unitary management documents and make a decision concerning those, and the federal court's hands would be pretty much tied in being able to help us, and therefore, technically, you really don't have any recourse, but that's what they're telling us. We could go to the federal district court for remedy.
And that is really scary.
Mm-hmm.
And see, the Montana Water Course, just like the Colorado Water Course, they've been a place where there's a law to compare it to, and there's some standards, and, you know, decisions are made, and people are on the ground. You take it up to that federal level, and look what happens. So, you know, the federal god, right, replaces mm-hmm. everything local with its own, quote, court of competent jurisdiction. So it's just another example of where the federal god has moved in to take over people's common sense.
Well, ladies, we've got about 20 minutes left. I want to make sure that any messages that you want to get out there, Terry, as far as, you know, where people might contribute to this effort, you know, where should they go again to let the ones that are not in chat that are listening know where they should go to get information and support this, perhaps even some contact information on who they might contact to let them know how they feel.
Sure. As I said before, we could use any assistance, you know, resources possible, you know, information, materials, people, money, whatever, would be extremely helpful. We operate on a very low budget. Most of the money comes out of our pockets, personally, but we've been able to do a lot with a little bit of money because we have a very small, dedicated group of people that work very hard to make sure that we're working productively and effectively and getting the message out about this. And I think that, Terry and Dr. Kate, I think you posted, we have a water rights blog. It's westernmtwaterrights.blogspot.com or .wordpress.com. And we have a lot of information out there, a lot of the documents. We have a lot of commentary and a lot of great information out there for people to get up to speed concerning this issue. We've also developed two water rights PowerPoint narratives that we have posted on Vimeo, and I believe those links have been sent out as well. Please look at them and get familiar with it and share that with other people, because Terry's absolutely right. This problem exists everywhere. We often have the discussion amongst our small group about if we had it all to do over again, would we be here? And we realize that there's probably no place else we can go because this problem exists everywhere. So that's a big problem. I can be contacted. I have a Skype telephone number. It's area code 406-626-3353. And if you want to see the state documents and the tribal documents, I believe the tribe's website is cskt.org, and the Montana Department of Natural Resources and Conservation, DNRC, their website is, let me just look that up here real quick, it's dnrc.mt for Montana.gov. And they have copies of the partially complete documents out there and kind of a historical record, I guess, of the documents that have been put forth. They also have audio recordings of the compact meetings that I think for about the last year and a half, they hold those about once a month. So there's a lot of good information out there. It's just that it's not complete information, so it's very difficult to understand the whole water compact in and of itself.
Terry Dodd, I think you're muted.
I think you're right. Let's take a few phone calls. Is that okay, Terry?
Sure.
Let's. Area code 303 has been patiently waiting for a long time. I believe that's our friend Brian. Brian, is that you?
That is me. Terry, I dealt with this situation personally in Ravalli County, right down the road from where this lady is at. And Ickley moved in and tried to cause the people of Ravalli County two things, zoning and unwanted sewer systems, which would have cost the a very small population in Florence, Montana, about $11 million, approximately. Oh, maybe 2,000 people at the very most. And what we did is, I think, unique to this kind of situation. We caused a referendum. We had a vote. We mobilized the people, and we shut down their sewer systems. We shut down their zoning with, I'm thinking, almost an 80% in disfavor of those two things, vote.
I'm very familiar with some of the things that they've done down in Ravalli County. I've got some good friends that live down in that area. And you're right, they're very well organized. They've been able to make some significant change down there, and they're a great example for a lot of people. And the one message that I get from them is, even though they've been very successful in doing that, the one thing you have to remember is that the enemy never gives up. They keep continuing to try to work it from a different angle. So once you're awake to this and you start fighting it, it's a never-ending battle because you have to stay vigilant forever.
Well, absolutely.
This.
I could. Oh, sorry.
Oh, that's okay.
I couldn't agree more, but you've got to begin somewhere, and so you need to start mobilizing your troops and organizing, I believe, for a referendum. The people will speak the loudest. Forget all of the attorneys and the cheap-suited politicians and so on and so forth. Forget those people. They're not important. All they are is purposeful obstructions. And, you know, I mean, we had one for years down in Hamilton, And we finally got rid of him because they're just absolute, they're paid pestilence. And so until you take it to the people and express to them that this is not an Indian situation, this is a ICLEI situation, this is a worldwide government situation, then you're going to be making progress, and you'll have your troops ready to move at a moment's notice when the next problem arises.
True. You know, concerning a referendum, I'm a little bit unclear just because this is a state compact. So are you envisioning that this would be something that would be a statewide? You know, because that's kind of what I'm thinking as far in terms of this compact itself and dealing with it and beating it back. We do understand it needs to be done at the legislative level. But if you're talking about actually putting forth a referendum, then I'm not really sure. We're talking about a 3 or 4 month period of time before this is going to be passed off to our legislature to vote on. And I don't, I'm an accountant, so I kind of, have to think through those details of it. So I'm not exactly sure how we might be able to accomplish that in just a few short months, but I think it's an excellent idea, and I agree with you. It's got to be the people that pull together as a united front to beat this back. Absolutely, that's where this needs to go.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying about them repeating themselves. They do it all of the time, but the important thing to remember is that the attorneys and the bad actors, the federal government, they're all in the same boat. They're all rowing with the same oar. And, maybe they switch hands and say, follow this hand, while they put it overboard or something. But they are all the enemy. And so it's important that the people understand what they, the enemy, are doing to you. I don't mean you personally, but you in that particular county in the Flathead area, it's all the same thing, and it's all worldwide. And that was one of the very first things that became apparent to the group in Ravalli County, is suddenly we recognized that we were in the middle of a storm. We were in the eye of a storm for at least that period of time. And that we had to act accordingly with the people versus the entire infrastructure against us. And we threw them off, and I'm very proud to say I was a part of that.
Awesome. Brian, Dr. Kate, what a wonderful idea. Would you be willing to work with Terry offline on the idea of a referendum?
I'd be happy to. Please take me offline, when you feel you want to, and I will give Terry my email and all of that stuff, and we'll work together.
Very good. Thank you.
I'll be glad to connect. I've got Brian's information, so I'll pass that on.
Very good.
Thank you very much. It was nice, a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.
Good to have you back on, Brian.
Thank you. Nice being here.
I assume everyone understands and knows what ICLEI is. That's that International Council for Local Environmental Initiatives, which is basically going after local governments for sustainability. It is related to the UN and to Agenda 21, and they're coming into these local communities in a very subtle way. They're using things like bicycle paths to make people think they're just wonderful, pleasant people, when the truth of the matter is they are very sinisterly doing the same sort of stuff that's happening with the water in western Montana. So, I mean, it's just one of the things I mentioned a while ago that they come at you from a lot of different directions on, and that's one of them. 406, you're live.
Hello?
Yes.
Hello?
Hi.
Hello?
Who's calling,
yes,
please?
This is Clarice Ryan.
Clarice.
Yes. Hi.
I'm so excited to have you getting the word out over the air and you've covered a tremendous amount of information. The thing that I would like to see is take a look at is who is the target audience that is the most incensed and the most apt to be actively concerned. And we can see it in the audiences that you had down at St. Ignatius and in Polson. And it's the irrigators. It's the people that are close, the farmers, the ranchers that are closest to the land where they are the greatest, the largest users of water. And right now we have the county fairs starting in every county. And right now, guess who comes with all their pigs and cows and chickens and so forth? It's the farmers. And so what we need to do right now is get out to those people that are congregating in the county fairs and so forth. They're there. We need also to reach the farm bureaus, the people that participate in the farmers' markets, the ag industries, the cattlemen's association. We've got to get these people alerted to the dangers of conservation easements that are after their open lands, their open space, their farms and ranch lands. This is where these people in the tribes are hitting is the irrigator. They turned out by the hundreds. Nobody else pays much attention. 1% of the population of the United States is producing all the food. And I personally was very much involved in the San Joaquin Valley that had 20 agricultural products. In fact, I worked with the producers there of 20 products. I'm familiar with all their operations of processing their foods and so forth. And when that delta smelt, 1.5 inches came in, claiming that it needed more water than anybody else, all of a sudden that whole productive valley has become a desert. The same with Klamath Falls. I was in Klamath Falls. And 10 years ago, and like you say, they never give up. And they were turning off irrigation water at that time. Right now, as we speak, they are ready to take out all the dams on the Klamath River. Those dams is what they're after. They're after the stored water. They're after all of this. So ICLEI, yes, it is a concern, but it deals with towns and communities. Take a look at who is using the water and the places where they're targeting us. It's ag. It's ag lands. It's the 1% of the population, and it shouldn't be all that difficult to get those people tuned in. Target mm-hmm. their organizations. Now, looking beyond, where does this all go? Have you heard of the law of the sea? Anything having to do with water is run. Water, when it hits the top of a mountain, it starts traveling in one direction and it's headed to the ocean. Law of the sea has 70% of the Earth's surface. And Obama has been busy, very busy, getting together the Interagency Ocean Policy Task Force. And in support of it, he has the Executive Order 13547, Stewardship of the Ocean, Our Coasts, and the Great Lakes. And the United States has the largest body of fresh water in the world. We have the Ogallala Aquifer underneath Nebraska and the Middle West where I'm from. That's fresh water, and Ted Turner is after that. These people are targeting. They aren't using the shotgun approach to hit all the people that are sound asleep and can't tear themselves away from their TVs. Those people whose livelihoods depend on water are the ones who are out there close to the land and trying to get food to produce for us. That's where they're targeting their attention and their attacks, and we need to pay attention to those groups of people, and it simplifies a great deal investment in time and investment.
You know, Grace,
who have their ears?
You're absolutely right. And we are seeing the irrigators feeling empowered to speak out about this, and I mentioned earlier that they are retaining an attorney to form an LLC to represent them, and that's a very good thing because they're getting their voice. They're going to actually be putting forth a proposal to make the stipulation agreement more equitable and fair, and one that will give them what they need. And I would like to mention something very interesting that I'm seeing. I've actually contacted a couple of organizations that represent the farmers and the irrigators and the ranchers, and they're here in Montana, but their constituency is the farmers and ranchers. And I said, I've called them and I spoke to some of their leadership and said, well, are you aware of this water rights issue and what position do you have on it? And basically they're telling me that, yes, they're aware, they're monitoring the situation, but anything, any position statement that they make or anything that they do has to fold within their formal policy. In other words, they don't have the political courage or backbone to come out and speak out against this. So they're going to just sit and wait and see. And I'm saying to them, what's wrong with you? You're representing these people. You're supposed to provide leadership for them, and you refuse to speak out because you don't, because you understand it's a divisive issue, and you don't have the courage to speak out about it. So I think that people like the irrigators and the farmers and the ranchers, they need to hold these people accountable and force them to take a stand about concerning this. We're talking about a few short months before this thing gets to the legislature, and these people are waiting to see what happens with it before they do anything or speak out on it. There's something wrong with that.
That's right. But I think that when we start doing the promotions and trying to get people out for audiences, you have proven that the irrigators are the ones that turn out. And I think that if you could focus, we only have so much money and so much time. I think what we need to do is wake these people up and maybe, I won't say scare them, but see that there is a need for concern and actual activity. They need awareness. I beg your pardon?
I want to come back to Brian's point because I think it's worth considering. We've got about 4 minutes left, and I want to get this point in before the show's over. I really appreciate, and you articulated it so well, Clarice. You know, what you said is really valuable. This concept of a referendum, let's say, for example, before we discount it, let's say, for example, that you don't have enough time, that it's going to be too difficult to get enough signatures because I believe in order to get a referendum on the ballot or whatever, it depends on, you know, whether or not you're going through the legislature to get them to vote on something or whether you're putting it to a public vote. And I don't want to get into that debate at the moment. But the point is let's say that you go after that type of approach that Brian was talking about. In a worst-case scenario, you're going to educate a lot of people, and you're going to also force the media to acknowledge this conflict. It's a great way of getting free publicity and getting the word out to the general public on the topic. So even if you're not successful in getting it on a ballot, you're going to accomplish what you're really trying to accomplish, and that is to raise awareness and to get people to take a stand against what's going on and to educate them. So
yeah.
Any feedback from that, Terry?
The only thing that I would say, I agree it's an excellent idea. In doing my homework, and I wasn't thinking about this in particular with regard to a referendum, I believe that there's a mandated timeline where you have to file in order to be able to start the process of gathering names through a petition. And I will have to go back and do some homework on it, but I believe that we are well past that deadline.
Well, I think you're probably right on the public one, on the public vote. But there's another process, and I believe it's true in Montana as well, but it may not be. I know here in Colorado we have two different ways of going at it. You can petition to get the legislature to look at something, or you can petition to get it onto a public vote. And one, okay. I'm sitting here just with a mental block on what the two are. One is a referendum, and the other one is something else.
Okay.
So you might want to look at that because you still got time to get it into your next session for your legislature, even if you aren't able to get it out for the public vote. So do a little homework on that one. We got about a minute and a half left. I want to give you the floor, Terry.
Okay. Well, I just want to thank you for giving us the opportunity to get the word out on this issue. It is something that impacts us all, whether we realize it or not. And we need to step back and take a look at the bigger picture of this and understand not only what this is doing to ourselves but to our neighbors and you know, people throughout the country and actually throughout the world. I mean, this is not just a United States problem as well. So Dr. Kate's right. This is the new world order, and they've been very effective. They've had a huge head start on us, and we're trying to beat back the monster. And it is an overwhelming thing at times, but to have the opportunity to share information and try to inform people is really very much appreciated.
Well, you've been a wonderful guest, and you've really articulated well tonight the problem. I think everybody's really got a clear understanding of what's going on up there now. And so we very much appreciate you taking the time to be with us, and we want to make you aware that if there's any updates or additional things you'd like to bring forward, you're welcome to be back here at Walls in Our Minds. Just contact either Kate or myself, and we'll be glad to give you more time.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. See everyone next week for Walls in Our Minds. Good night, Red. Good night, Kate.